They'll be late.
Thank you.
Nothing to do with your. You have a candle to turn in now. Your article is about it. So they said they're going to make him the head of international.
But how?
What?
Can be. It's impossible.
It's going to be difficult. Dave. It's nonsense. Half past 10.
I'm telling you.
Thank you. station is not ready yet, and we can't wait any longer. So I want to be suggesting that we allow FSC to start. They are ready. We have hard copies. We are still waiting for the IT people to come and connect here. Hence, you also see the light. The main light is not on. So we can't wait forever. Time is not on our side. We have to attend to other issues soon after this. Do we agree, members? Not a big issue. We'll use the hard copies or your iPads or tablets. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Comrade Wai. Members, this session today is going to be a capacity building. You remember last year we have postponed several sessions that we intended to have on capacity building, and they are happening as per our request. So because of time pressure, we kept on postponing them, and we thought because capacity building was not an event, it will be an ongoing thing. So today we decided to have this session of capacity building, a workshop session. And we have the three institutions. We have FSC, we have SALGA, we have Treasury to make presentation. So what I wanted to bring to your attention, honorable members, is that when we engage with what they are going to present, we should not come with oversight questions, because it's not that session. We should engage in the presentation in a form of a workshop, not oversight questions. I don't know if I'm clear. It looks like honorable Mkiva is not agreeing with me or is not understanding what I'm saying. Okay. Thank you so much. So if we can just be able to draw that thin line, and I understand it's going to be difficult, we can now go on and hand over to FSC to start with the presentation. We'll use the hard copies. Thank you. Prof, over to you.
Thank you, honorable chairperson and members. Chair, just before we start, I thought I just wanted to, because you raised the matter in the last meeting, if I'm wrong, to raise in this meeting, please feel free to stop me. You suggested that you send a letter to the FSC for certain documents and we haven't delivered. Truth be told, we didn't get a letter from your office, and second, it was also not directed at us. So I just thought, let me just clear that one, because otherwise it's on the public record that we haven't delivered. Then, Chair, today's presentation I'm going to hand over to Ansuya Dara Maharaj, who is our committee secretary, commission secretary, and chair managing my office. She's been doing this for a couple of times over the last couple of years in terms of presenting who and what the FFC is, long before I joined the FFC. So, chairperson, with permission, I'm asking Ansuya to do the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, maybe before you come in, my apologies. Just to confirm what Prof is saying, I have also received a confirmation, Prof, that you were not part of the people that or the institutions that we have written requested response on. Thank you.
Thank you, honorable chairperson and honorable members. Just in terms of the Financial and Fiscal Commission, the establishment and function, the Financial and Fiscal Commission, FFC, is a constitutional institution arising directly from the Constitution. And its formation, constitution, establishment, and so forth is quite nicely captured in Chapter 13 of the Constitution of 1996 as amended. Basically, the FFC makes recommendations as envisaged on Chapter 13 of the Constitution to the three spheres of government. government on all financial and fiscal matters. The vision of FFC is to provide evidence-based advice. So all advice that is given by the FFC is evidence-based, as you would have noticed in various briefings that we come to the Parliament for. The mission is to provide expert independent advice on macroeconomic and fiscal frameworks for promoting a sustainable and equitable intergovernmental fiscal relations system through evidence-based research and analysis to ensure the realization of our constitutional values. So what is the foundation and the framework, the regulatory framework of how the FFC is based, apart from the Constitution? So in Chapter 13 of the Constitution, firstly, the recommendations are quite nicely covered in Chapters 214, 218, 228, 229, 230, and 230 capital A. And I will go through each clause for you to actually, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members, for you to then have a look at what exactly is the FFC doing. Just to also always keep in the back of your mind that national legislation that's referred to in all these sections in the Constitution may be enacted only after any recommendations from the FFC have been considered. So that is something which, Honourable Chairperson and Members, that you must always keep in mind when you're going through various briefings from other institutions and so forth where the FFC has been consulted in that respect. In terms of Section 214 of the Constitution, that deals with the equitable shares and allocation of revenue. Here it clearly states, and if I may, Honourable Chair, Honourable Member, if I may quote the reference section, that says, an Act of Parliament must provide for the equitable division of revenue raised nationally among the national, provincial and local spheres of government, the determination of each province's equitable share of the provincial share for that revenue, and any other allocations to provinces, local government or municipalities from the national government's share of that revenue, and any conditions on which these allocations may be made. So the Act referred to in subsection 1 may be enacted only after the three spheres of government and the FFC have been consulted, and also to keep in mind that any recommendations of the Commission have been considered. So that's a very important part as well. The recommendations must not only be made, but must also be considered. In terms of government guarantees, the national government, a provincial government, or a municipality may guarantee a loan only if the guarantee complies with any conditions set out in national legislation. National legislation referred to in subsection 1 may be enacted only after any recommendations of the FFC have been considered. There too you can see, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members, the operative words that the FFC recommendation must be considered. In terms of provincial taxes, it's also covered in section 228 of the Constitution. At the moment, I'm just going through the foundation, the regulatory framework of the Constitution as such, and these are the relevant sections that you can read. I'm just sifting that out. In terms of provincial taxes, a provincial legislature may impose taxes, levies, and duties other than income tax, value-added tax, general sales tax, rates on the property or custom duties, and flat rate surcharges on any tax, levy, or duty that is imposed by national legislation other than on corporate income tax, value-added tax, rates on property or custom duties. Everything dealing with taxes as such. The power of a provincial legislature to impose taxes, levies, duties, and surcharges may not be exercised in any way. Then Section 2 of that Section 228A refers to the framework within which it may operate. But what's very important is that it must be regulated in terms of any Act of Parliament, then again, only after the recommendations of FFC have been considered. Then we go to Section 229 of the Constitution. Section 229 deals with the municipal fiscal powers and functions. It speaks again about the rates, taxes, levies, surcharges, and so forth, and the power of the municipality to impose rates 2 to 9, still on the basis of the foundation, still looking at the constitution about when two municipalities, section 2 to 9 deals with when two municipalities have the same fiscal powers and functions with regard to the same areas, that an appropriate division of those powers and functions must be made in terms of national legislation. Here too, it talks about that this section doesn't preclude the sharing of revenue rates between municipalities and so forth. But here too, it deals with the fact that it's only after organized local government and the FFC have been consulted, and any recommendations from the FFC must be considered. Provincial laws, section 230, which I'm sure honourable chairperson and honourable members deal with a lot from time to time, where a province may raise loans for capital or current expenditure in accordance with national legislation, but loans for current expenditure may be raised only when necessary for bridging purposes during a fiscal year. Year two, FFC must be consulted and all its recommendations must be considered. 230 capital A, dealing with municipal loans, which are made in accordance with national legislation. This section pertains to the raising of loans for capital, current expenditure, binding the council for future loans or investments and so forth in terms of the municipality. Here as well, the FFC must be consulted. Its recommendations, its views on the financial advice must be considered. So this is actually the framework, and this is the foundation, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members, of the Constitution and the obligations which have been imposed, where FFC must be consulted, it must make recommendations, and its recommendations must be considered. There are also other constitutional, there are other regulatory frameworks, other laws that also covers why FFC must be consulted, and FFC's recommendations must also be considered. And the other laws that you look at is the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act, Municipal Fiscal Powers and Functions Act, the Local Government Municipal Systems Act, the Provincial Finance Management Act, and the Municipal Finance Management Act of 2003 as amended, the Provincial Finance and the Municipal Finance, Provincial Tax Regulation Process Act, the IGFR, Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Framework Act of 2005, the Borrowing Powers of Provincial Government Act. So all these pieces of legislation, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members, covers where FFC must be consulted. It is on page 11 of the slide. Thereafter, if you look at each one of these relevant pieces of legislation and you look at each section that pertains to the FFC, it's clearly stated why FFC must be consulted, on which matters it must be consulted, and what happens after FFC has been consulted. Let's look at some of these pieces of the regulatory framework. Let's look at some of these pieces of legislation, like we looked at the Constitution, on why FFC must be consulted, and on what are the reasons, what happens after that. So let's look at the Money Bills Amendment Procedures and Related Matters Act of 2009. It provides for the procedure to amend the money bills before Parliament and for norms and standards for amending money bills before provincial legislature and related matters. Here, the committees on finance and appropriations must consult with the FFC and allow the minister the opportunity to respond to any amendments proposed at least 3 days prior to the submission of the report to the relevant house. So it tells you who must be consulted, the FFC, why it must be consulted, and it also gives you the time frame within which the submission of the report must be done. And Section 8 then goes on to talk about the Standing and Select Committees on Finance. What it does, it therefore takes the FFC's recommendations into consideration and submits a report on the fiscal framework and revenue proposals to the National Assembly and NCOP, the National Council of Provinces. Section 9 then goes on to talk about the Standing and Select Committees of Appropriations. takes the FFC recommendations into consideration as per the constitutional requirement, then submits a report on the division of revenue to the National Assembly and National Council of Provinces. So that section clearly covers it. When you're looking then at the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act of 1997, as Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members are aware, this piece of legislation promotes cooperation between the three spheres of government on fiscal, budgetary, financial matters. It prescribes a process for the determination of an equitable sharing and allocation of revenue raised nationally, and it provides for all matters that are related to what I had just said now on the fiscal, budgetary matters and so forth. So here as well, at least 10 months or a later date agreed on between the Minister or the Commission, and the Commission, before the start of each financial year, the Commission must submit to both Houses of Parliament and the Provincial Legislature for tabling in the Houses, and the Legislature, also to the Minister, the recommendations for that financial year regarding these two things: an equitable division of revenue raised nationally amongst three spheres of government, and secondly, any other allocation to provinces, local government or municipalities from national government's share of that revenue and any conditions on which those allocations should be made. So here it speaks quite clearly and literally, succinctly about FFC's role regarding the annual submission on the division of revenue. Then you're looking at your IGFR Act of 1997, Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act of 1997. What does the FFC have to do? What role does it play regarding the IGFR Act? So after receiving any recommendations of the Commission, but before the Division of Revenue Bill is introduced in the National Assembly, the Minister must consult. So the operative word there is must, it's mandatory. The Commission must be consulted in terms of subsection 3 at least 14 days before the Division of Revenue Bill is introduced. When the Division of Revenue Bill is introduced, it must be accompanied by a memorandum explaining how the bill takes into account of each of the matters listed in section 214. Remember, right at the beginning, we spoke about the Constitution, the different section, we covered section 214. The extent to which account was taken of any recommendations of the Commission submitted to the Minister in terms of section 9 or as a result of consultations with the Commission in terms of subsection 3 of this section. So this also, the IGFR speaks clearly about how the Commission must be consulted in this regard, and the FFC's role on four important things: submission on the fiscal framework and revenue proposal, submission on the division of revenue bill and appropriations bill, submission on the medium-term budget policy statement, and submission on the adjusted division of revenue bill and adjusted appropriations bill. So slide 15, and it is in bold, the FFC's role on those four bullet points that is extremely important, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Member. Then we still, remember, we're still looking at the foundation, we're still looking at the fabric of the regulatory framework, we're still looking at the mandatory obligation and the role, the very important role of the FFC in the Constitution and with Parliament as well. So the Municipal Fiscal Powers and Functions Act of 2007, what does that have to do with the FFC? Here again, it regulates the exercise by municipalities of their power to impose surcharges on fees for services provided. And here this section deals a lot with taxes, levies, duties, and so forth. Here as well, the Minister must consult the Commission before any regulations are made under the Act in accordance with the Constitution. So regulations are actually what unpacks the Act. It operationalizes the Act. Think of your Act as something strategic, something looking at things on a very high level, and then your regulations just regulate it, operationalize it. But the Minister must consult with the Commission before that. Your Local Government Municipal Systems Act of 2000, this provides for the core principles, mechanisms, the processes that are necessary to enable municipalities to move progressively towards the social and economic upliftment of local communities and ensure the universal access of essential services. So here as well, a cabinet member or deputy minister seeking to initiate initiate the assignment of a function or power by way of an act of parliament to municipalities in general or any category of municipalities must, within a reasonable time before the draft act providing for such an assignment is introduced, request the FFC, and this is what it must request the FFC to do, to assess the financial and fiscal implications of the legislation. After informing the FFC of the possible impact of such assignment. So they mustn't, it's not something which the FFC must just be asked to assess. It is something which they are obliged to inform the FFC the impact of such assignment. So those are very mandatory words, very important words, something which they must do, something which they are obliged to do. And this is set down clearly in the Local Government Municipal Assistance Act on slide 17. You will find that nicely captured. Then to go on, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members, to look at your Municipal Finance Management Act of 2003. Here, this deals with the sustainable management of financial affairs of municipalities, still dealing with the norms and standards, dealing with the local sphere of government as such. So national legislation, directly or indirectly amending this act or providing for the enactment of subordinate legislation that may conflict with this act may be introduced in Parliament only after the Minister and the FFC have been consulted in writing on the contents of the draft legislation and have responded in writing. All previously when I mentioned the fabric that FFC must be consulted and so forth, yes, it is a reading in of the legislation. It may not be there in the literal reading, but it may be there in the reading in. FFC must be consulted in writing. How they consult, the manner that they consult, and so forth, obviously you will address it to the Commission, to the Chairperson, and you will follow what the regulation and the Act says, and that's how your consultation process will then unfold, the various steps and the various processes that it takes, as well as how you will inform the FFC. So what are, this is now, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members, the foundation, the fabric. So there's no cracks in the foundation as such. Very strong, very sturdy foundation. It clearly sets out in terms of the laws and the regulations, why FFC must be consulted, the manner in which it must be consulted, what is expected from the FFC, what happens after that, proof that furnished to the various committee that the FFC has been consulted and so forth. So it's quite a literal interpretation. There's no technical aspects to it. The law is very clear. It's very tactical. It's there's no ambiguity to it as such. What are then, apart from this, now the annual outputs that are targeted at finance and appropriations committees and so forth? So all financial and fiscal matters affecting public finance, whether it's vertical, whether it's horizontal, division of revenue and appropriations. So what happens? The annual submission for the division of revenue, this is tabled, as Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members are well aware, at the end of May. It is, and previously, if you go back and recall, when I went through the regulatory framework and I gave the time frames and so forth, it's submitted 10 months prior to tabling of the Division of Revenue Bill by the Minister, and it contains recommendations, proposals for the following fiscal year and NTEA. The submission on the fiscal framework and revenue proposals, remember the one slide I said, look at the bold, the four bullet points, the caps, so that's what I'm now unpacking. The submission on the fiscal framework and revenue proposals, Division of Revenue Bill, Appropriations Bill, you recall that's in February, the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill, Adjustment Appropriation Bill, and the Medium-Term Budget Policy Statement. Yes, that contains the FFC's response to the annual adjustment budget and specific policy priority areas. All this that I'm speaking of, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members, is nicely contained in 19. So it's something which you can actually look at and diarize these days, because these are very important days. And then with your permission, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members, I'll hand over the last two slides and further communication from our Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you. So the last two slides essentially just speaks to the fiscal decentralization system, especially when Mark talks about the devolution of experience of powers and functions. I think it's an important thing to note that sort of many times people talk loosely about decentralization, but decentralization has got a number of components. There's the, what we call deconcentrated part of it, where central government or the center of a particular function still makes the decisions. And this is part of the administration, where things get implemented. And then there are the issue of delegations broadly, which provides it's part of a policy of a rule that says another level of government can do something. And it's such even in the province where the provincial department might say the regional office can do certain things. But the important thing to remember about delegation is not a permanent thing, it can be withdrawn. So devolution is much more permanent, it can only change by a form of legislation or resolution. So there is then a permanency in the system, in the fiscal decentralization system, with regard to expenditure powers and functions. The Constitution and both the various financial laws, including the Public Finance Act, makes provision for it. But before we give this particular slide, just to give members a sense of how the cake gets considered. So at the national level, we have national functions like defense, justice, police, tertiary education. In parts, tertiary education used to be also a part in the province, especially when it comes to the hard part of it, academic hospitals. But there was also a shared arrangement in terms of the finance, in terms of the conditional grant was what we are looking at. There are functional areas of concurrent national and provincial legislature competence. The Schedule A is quite clear about education at all levels, obviously excluding tertiary education, health services and arts. At the provincial government, there are exclusive functions. So the Constitution makes provision for exclusive functions and it makes provision for shared functions. The Constitution uses the phrase concurrent functions, meaning different levels of government might be responsible for the functional area. Now, what is quite critical is that the tension that sits, and it can be a healthy tension between national government, provincial government, and municipalities at times, and between national provinces and between municipalities and provinces on a particular function. It is always useful to interrogate the principle of the function, which in many instances sits either at the national level or within the provinces, depending on whether it's a provincial function relative to a municipality. To disaggregate, to unpack the responsibilities within the function. Because remember, the way the Constitution, the logic of the Constitution is that there's a mandate. The mandate says to you what the functions are. Within that function, you get to know what are the roles and responsibilities and the location of that. That in itself then says what are the service delivery obligations. And then, because we are a developmental state, in terms of the Constitution doesn't say it, but the Constitution makes an inclination to it. And then following from those responsibilities is then the service. And then based on the service is the financing of those things. That's why it's very critical to, I've raised it before, but I think it's an important point to make. If you forget everything that I say to you today, honorable members and chair, one of the things that national governments get away with is that they're introducing new policies, new forms of legislation, and it doesn't get costed in price. And as a result, as the program runs out, implementation-wise, people will then come back to you, whether it's the minister or the DG or whoever, that will say that we're underfunded. We don't have enough funding. We're going to go back to Treasury, you know. Forgetting obviously that there's a cabinet that makes the decisions, and it's not crazy decisions to make in the absence of cabinet. So all policies need to be costed and priced, and when those policies are not costed and priced, the specific department raising that because my experience working in the space since 95 has been some departments managed to do the costing and pricing in the first 10 to 12 years. Of late, the costing and pricing doesn't happen. So it creates a burden on the fiscus. But it also doesn't create surety and stability within the system as to what the cost of it is. There's also another matter which I thought is important is that when function shifts between provinces to national, or national to provinces, and to municipalities, even the shifts of those functions needs to be properly costed and priced because there's a drag on effect. It's an old fiscal quick issue about finance for no function. Whether it's upwards, sideways, or downwards, the financials need to follow where the functions are going. But we sometimes forget what are the administrative costs that's built into that. So the point I'm making is that when the function gets shifted, when new policy and legislation gets introduced, it must be costed. So whatever comes to you, it's important that you ask, what is the implementation plan? What's the time frame for it? What is the costing and the pricing? And then how does it impact on the current existing budget of a department or function? And what is the new money that they're asking for? It's critical questions that needs to be asked. It doesn't matter who it is. Whether it's the treasury itself, because in my old employer's place, there are also people that push policies, which is not necessarily part of the budget and the financing and the governmental arrangements. The ICT issue is a classic about that. So the issue is that then at the provincial level we also find exclusive functions such as legal licensing museums and other national museums that's in the provinces, provincial planning. There's also those provincial recreation and amenities. At the local government, the areas of they are concurrent, as I said, shared functions between national and provincial legislative competencies and local government matters in terms of schedule 4B. Water and sanitation services, limited portable water supply systems and domestic water waste, sewage disposal, etc. Electricity and gas articulation sits in local government. You will probably especially when it comes to literacy and gas articulation, there is a particular history there, and it's quite useful for members to know that the distribution of electricity, if the articulation gets interpreted as that, is actually the municipal responsibilities, local government's responsibilities. It's not Eskom's responsibility, constitutionally and otherwise. But what has happened in 1996 because of a decision that was taken by the incoming government that all citizens must have access to electricity. President Mandela himself declared that Eskom will be the last resort of supply. Because municipalities were not ready, we had more than 300 municipalities and eventually now. I mean, you know the track from a messed up apartheid, new democracy, Bantustan, tribal system, municipalities, and all of it eventually came together. So that led to that issue about municipalities not being in the front line of delivering on that is one of those hard nuggets that needs to be looked at going forward. Because there has been threats to Eskom in terms of Salda wanting to take Eskom to court. The same with the municipalities. There's now a court case in the courts from the Cape Town municipality. So it's the energy sector is quite an issue because for a municipality, electricity was a mainstream of revenue. But as you see now, there are lots of issues around that. And I think it would be a great conversation to have going forward on the two utilities, water and sanitation, on the one hand, and electricity and gas on the other hand, because those are the two things where there are pushes for access to people. Then there's the functional areas of exclusion, which is Schedule 5B. Now these schedules, Honorable Chair, it's found in the Constitution that says who is responsible for what. That municipalities are responsible for municipal roads, for dealing with noise pollution. Noise pollution, refuse dumps, refuse removals, solid waste disposal, street trading, and stuff like that. So there's a couple of. In fact, as honourable members will pick up, there are a number of. There's also the conversation that it would be great to have at another time. Is the proportionality of the responsibility of provinces, but in particular municipalities, relative to their revenue base, relative to an agenda that there must be political decision making and management of municipalities. In fact, the view is that for a country with our levels of economic development, especially now, can we afford 247 municipalities? Is it not a great opportunity with the district model to rearrange our municipalities so that there's a spillover, there's also a pooling effect, but there's also a way that we work with the networks. I mean, Gauteng is a great example of regional municipalities like your Johannesburg and Tshwane and yeah. Then just the then we've given you the slide with the blocks, the red blocks. It's essentially explaining the vertical division. We try to use the colors of the flag there. So there's direct charges against the National Revenue Fund. I think the Treasury will further explain that to you, how that happens. But the essential issue is that those direct costs the biggest direct cost to the National Revenue Fund is to pay debt and payment service cost. And then there's a couple. There's obviously a parliament that has a first call to it. We call it first calls to the budget. This parliament has got a first call to the budget. There's also the judiciary that's got a first call to the budget. And if you want to push the envelope around that, one could also probably say that some of those impactful programs, I mean, particular social grants, is probably a first call to the budget, even though it doesn't always get considered in that way. But it is all those entitlement programs, and obviously the Constitutional Court has ruled on some of those things. Then there's the provincial part. So what then happens is that there's a horizontal division of the revenue between provinces. It's driven by two things: an equitable share allocation. And the equitable share allocation is population driven, and it looks at poverty numbers. And it's the issue that fits in there, that of the quintile 1 to quintile 5. So it's essentially the when we put all these things together, equitable share allocation to provinces, in particular to strengthen social protection. And social protection is about health, education, income transfers, and a number of services that contribute directly to protecting people from the ravages of poverty, but also to protect them against shocks that the families and households faces on it. And then there's obviously the part of that, the money that goes to provinces is a conditional grant. And conditional grant essentially is driven by two main primary issues. One is driven by national policy priority, when national government has decided this is what we're going to do, but there's not enough fiscal space within the province, but also there's not enough administrative and implementation capacity within the province. So that's the one reason, and to push a national policy. The other is a spillover issue, that if you introduce something in particular in a particular service, then the spillover effect is that it will, on the one hand, draw people. obviously there's the, there are indirect grants, but I think the Treasury officials will be able to explain some of that, because sometimes some of these things get, first it becomes an indirect grant, and later it will shift to potentially, I know in my years it will shift to a conditional grant, and then if things works okay, it gets put into the into the broader provincial purse for distribution. And then simply there's the appropriations. Those are the bills that we were dealing with. The appropriation bill, and it's the 10 departments. And clearly the committee's responsibility is to look at those concurrent functions that sits in to see exactly what are the effect on it. And there's the local division, or is that the division to municipalities. Obviously noting that provinces are highly dependent, if not completely dependent, on intergovernmental fiscal transfers, where municipalities are less dependent on intergovernmental fiscal transfers. I think what would be good to look at going forward is there are a number, more than 20 highly indebted municipalities. I mean, I just heard this today on the radio about the Mfuleni municipality. There might be a huge structural, functional, operational problems within these municipalities. It might be related to fraud and corruption, capacity issues, etc. The key issue, if you have all those issues, it also gets compounded with municipalities not having the fiscal base. There's no, generally, in those highly indebted municipalities, there are no fiscal base, there's no tax that can be collected. In fact, in some municipalities, I used to spend 18 months in the Free State, and there were municipalities that when they get money in from the national fiscus, it goes directly to paying ESCOM and paying staff salaries. Now surely you can't have in fact the point is that another level of government, or sphere, some people if you want to call it, is at risk of not being functional. And if you have a sphere of government that's not functional, you have a constitutional problem. Because the constitution creates these levels of government. So there is a need to look at the proportionality of capacities, and capacity is not only about money, it's a range of things, but also how we organize municipalities around the number of 50 million people that we have in the country, to use the stats now. There's also the issue of the Money Bills Amendment Procedures and Related Matters Amendment Act. It's the long act that we always refer to, the Money Bills. It's clearly that ANSUI has intimated to that the both these committees, whether it's in the NCOP or in the National Assembly, need to take into consideration our recommendation. But the committee's role is essentially on the question of oversight, and we think that the it also got to do with the ESA struggle that we have, is that it's not about parliament, it's about how our system works in terms of every 5 years there's an election, and as a result it's almost like the last term of parliament is not considered because it's a new term of parliament. And one of the key things that we're going to discuss with the legal section of parliament is how do we assist new parliamentarians in terms of the continuity of our recommendations.
Yes, I'll be right.
So you can see all of us now. I know that I was sitting outside and there was Stephen. I said, Stephen is dark, and Suya is darker, and I was the darkest in the darkness. But the key thing is that when we table our other reports, it is quite important that we are clear, but also that committee members ask us further questions so that we actually help. The assessment is essentially how do we then assess the committee to check whether the budget is tabled, obviously knowing other processes take in consideration the recommendations of the FFC. There are a number of submissions that we have made. The one that stands up always is the costing and pricing of functions and services, norms and standards. And I want to try to positively influence members of honourable members and chair that when a department or a function comes to you and say they're underfunded, the best way to push this conversation down the road is to ask were your functions costed? Were your policy costed? Was the administration costed relative to your policy responsibilities? Was the inputs that you delivered on the different functions, whether it's drugs somehow, whether it's staffing, whether it's equipment, whether it's infrastructure, have those matters been costed and priced to be able to know what do you need and what was given to you? Because there is a number of technocratic, bureaucratic gaming that's going on where the institution of, I'm not speaking with Treasury, but I'm just not because we've been part of the whole system for years, where Treasury gets blamed for certain things, but departments don't even understand their own budgets at times. There are 2008 recommendations that we've made. This list gives you essentially some of the recommendations that we've made with regard to the central issues that will face this committee on the accreditation of municipalities in terms of the inadequate capacity. There's a discussion that we currently are having with the chairperson of demarcation board because the demarcation board, they can come speak for themselves, but I need to say that we have been concerned about the amalgamation of municipalities and the character effect of that and the obligation that it places on a stable municipality given a range of resources to that. There are matters that we also have raised around the wage bill, especially the whole question of productivity. And I think it's a critical matter that needs to be discussed as to where are the productive functions within the administration relative to the other responsibilities within certain administrations. We have raised on a number of occasions the uncoordinated planning, an inadequate assessment of the collateral impact that one department's functions will have on another department's functions. There's also the slow carry through of presidential statements on what needs to be done and how that carries through in terms of the functions of departments and provinces. Early childhood is a classic. That's hanging somewhere, and as we said to you, to you 2 weeks ago or a week ago, that consideration should be given of the president probably to a proclamation or to do a regulation, whichever way, just to get permanence in the support of function. So that also creates stability because it's difficult for us also even to make an assessment whether we can experience the real changes that was articulated in terms of the shift of the early childhood development function. So there is the issue of the planning, and it's not the issue of the centralization of it, it's the issue of how does health plan relative to education relative to social development services and also to municipalities and provinces. Because if we were able to resolve that, I bet we will be able to see where the inefficiencies and where the efficiency gains need to be made. It's some of those things that we need to start thinking harder, given the environment that we're in. I'm not sure if it's anything like this. And then we were concerned at the time, but it's one of those conversations that we're having with the Treasury to start making sure that we properly evaluate the role and function of conditional grants. Because conditional grants, if you don't look at it properly, can be a mechanism that gets used to create increased centralization of functions. Remember, you pay the piper calls the tune. And we need to think about how do we use the conditional grant to affect service delivery, changes around service delivery and administration, and better delivery of services. The last slide is to say the functional cycle of the FFC. It includes the stuff that we do, includes the stuff that happens in Parliament. I'm talking about this drawing, which sometimes puzzles me. I can't really think that it doesn't have primary colors. I hope you can read it. I'm still doing this of A, C, D stuff, you know. The primary colors is not there, I can't see it properly. But the slide talks about the flow of stuff from where it comes and how it gets to FSC and how we get involved in it and how we get to this committee. And the last slide, if you can't remember how South Africa looks like, this is how it looks. Thank you, Chair, for all of the members.
Thank you, Prof. What a conclusion. This is how South Africa looks. We will now give the opportunity to Treasury for presentation. Thank God the lights are back. And I was laughing with Honorable Dedoite. Like, he also couldn't realize there was a button for the light on just behind us. And we called the people all the way to come and press the button to switch the light on. But it's not our area of operation anyway. We wouldn't know. It's understandable. DDG, over to you.
Honourable members, so our presentation, maybe the next slide, because our input here is trying to respond to what we were asked to do, reflect on how we interface with the committee and how we can best enable to do its oversight. So I will do some part of the presentation that I've got Ohali Sareku, who is responsible for the provincial budget analysis, and Stephen Kenyon, who comes from the public and planning part of our division, and Silo Mashaba, who comes from local government budget analysis, but focusing a lot on conditional grants. So each one of us will say something.
Hope you'll not say a lot at the time.
Yes,
but we appreciate that we will all speak.
We will try and not say too much, but at least we'll reflect, because we will reflect on the legislation and the division of revenue. I think a lot has already been reflected by FSC in terms of the content of some of the things that we're responding to. We'll also highlight a bit on the monitoring that we do. So in terms of legislation, we also are mandated by the Constitution, Section 215 and 216 of the Constitution, that mandate us to perform certain functions, which are therefore legislated through this suite of legislation that we see here, most of which were mentioned by the FFC. We also do treasury regulations and instructions, but we also give clarity and, in terms of circulars, guidelines, and some of the tools and engagements, and also capacity support where there are challenges. So in terms of how we are organized at the National Treasury, as you can see there, there are nine divisions that are supporting our ministry. And in those nine divisions, there is a core group that is called Budget Group. That is the core group that engages directly with the budget. Of course, we get supported by tax, as they make their inputs on tax, and asset and liability, which is responsible for our debt and borrowing, debt management and borrowing, and economic policy that does modeling. But at the end of the day, we pull together all that has to be submitted during the budget and tabling. So that is the budget office that usually engage with you with regards to the fiscal framework that gets tabled in the budget review. And public finance, that deals with the 40 departments that will engage with you on the appropriation bill. And intergovernmental relations, which is where I sit, which is responsible for planning of the transfers to provinces and local government and putting together the Division of Revenue Bill. So in terms of the Division of Revenue Bill, so the division of the nationally raised revenue is done between the three spheres of government. And the allocations and the decisions are really based largely on the functions that they are mandated to perform relative to the revenue raising power. So we'll see national departments that fully funded from national revenue, and we know that most of the revenue is collected at the national level. And provincial departments, which will depend on almost 96% of their funding from national revenue funds, and municipalities that on average will depend on 25% of their funding from national revenue funds, precisely because they have got a very strong revenue raising power that has been allocated to them. So the division of revenue, which is what we call the legal split between the three spheres of government, is done through a political consultation, quite a detailed and involved political consultation that takes place during the budget process that will usually be starting in June and working on the budget that will be tabled in February. So the next slide will then reflect the extent of consultation. So on the right, we reflect that the parliamentary recommendations that will arise from the deliberations on the budget and the FFC recommendations that come through in May and the mandate paper that needs to come through before we start the budget process. All those become key critical inputs into the budget process. So they then get processed through the technical meetings that takes place for the sector departments. So we engage a lot of the sector departments, but also we have organized departments also into function groups. We have health function groups, social development, economic development function groups. So that then that brings together a number of departments to begin to understand the policy dimensions there and what trade-offs we need to make in order to prioritize certain areas that need to be prioritized. Then we also engage at a technical level, intergovernmental technical committees, and we also have what we call Minicombat technical committee, which also feed into the minister's committee on the budget. So the Budget Council is key in terms of consulting at intergovernmental level, where we have got our MECs of finance, chaired by the Minister of Finance,
So that is the key consultative body with regards to provincial fiscal framework and the budget forum that includes SALGA that becomes key in consulting on local government. And all those engagements and the minister's committee on the budget, which then pulls together the recommendations that then go to cabinet, which are informed by this consultation that has taken place, tables the medium-term policy statement, which in actual fact should include not only the division of revenue, but also signal any changes in the conditional grants that will be incorporated in the next coming budget. So the recommendations of the parliamentary committees becomes key on the engagement of the MTPS that we take into account in preparation for the tabling of the budget in February. So the division of revenue that is tabled in the medium-term policy statement also complies with Section 6 of Money Bills and Related Matters Act, which actually clearly indicates that we should table proposed division of revenue between the spheres of government for the next 3 years, and also any substantial adjustments that could be necessary or planned on conditional plans need to be tabled. And which usually become a challenge because departments sometimes want to come when the budget is about to be tabled and want these major changes. But this actually brings that discipline in terms of the thinking through of the policy changes that drives conditional grants. And also we need to also consider the spending trends up to the 30th of September as we engage with the budget. So this therefore gives the Parliament an opportunity to consider any changes, the changes that are being proposed in the division of revenue, and make recommendations that executive has to consider ahead of tabling of the budget. So the content of the division of revenue the contents are also defined in the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act, which clearly says there must be division of revenue, and that articulates allocations to provinces and municipalities and also the supporting documents that respond to also requirements of the legislation which we will indicate. Then it follows the parliamentary hearings that then informs the approvals of the bill in the NA and NCOP ahead of president attention to the bills. So I think I can give you to run through this one.
Yes. Thank you, DDG. Good morning, honourable members and chair. So I'm just going to take you through the next few slides, which take you through the contents of the Division of Revenue Bill. I think this is a very well-timed session in that we're presenting the actual Division of Revenue Bill tomorrow. So this gives you the kind of skeleton of what should be there, and then tomorrow we'll present more of the policy decisions that determine the shape of things this year. So in the bill, and it's 300 and something odd pages, so it's such a lengthy document, the first part is the clauses and then the schedules, and that becomes the Division of Revenue Act once enacted. Then there's around 60 pages of explanatory memorandum, which also serves as an annexure to the budget review. And then there are several annexures and appendices that make up the conditional grant framework and the detailed allocations. So we'll go through each of those in turn just briefly, what you can expect to find there. So firstly, in the bill clauses, this is the legislation. Most of this remains the same from year to year, but this is what governs the transfers that are in the Division of Revenue Bill. So they're very important for giving the legal architecture here. And we've just highlighted, it doesn't come through so clearly on the projection there, but in bold in the text there, some of the clauses which are perhaps particularly important for the committee's oversight role, because I think that was part of what the invitation was asking us to highlight for you. So there are often questions about funds in the Division of Revenue, particularly a conditional grant, for example, you know, who can the committee hold accountable when things go wrong with a conditional grant? So clauses 9 and 10 in the bill set out the responsibilities of the transferring officer. So that's the national department that actually makes the transfer and that is responsible for the monitoring of the performance of both in non-financial, in other words, service delivery, and financial terms of how that money is spent by each of the recipient provinces or municipalities. And there's a little bit more detail there about the responsibilities for particular grants and particular types of grants. But that, those clauses set out very clearly what the responsibilities of the transferring officers are. And then similarly, sections 11 and 12 set out the responsibilities of the receiving officer. So that's now the municipality or the province that actually gets the money, has to spend it, has to do the procurement, etc., etc. So what are their responsibilities? What reports are they meant to submit, etc., etc.? Clause 17 allows the prescription of conditions, and that's very important for, you know, making these allocations conditional. And then clauses 18 to 20 describe the kind of consequence framework for in-year management of the system, and there were a couple of parliamentary recommendations last year around the consequence framework. So those clauses set out the options for withholding and what the procedures are to ensure that withholding is not done unfairly, and then similarly with the stopping and the reallocation of funds. So that's the kind of sets out the legal framework. The other clauses are also kind of equally important, and the Treasury's responsibilities are really enumerated throughout, but they are later in clauses 29 to 31, duties of municipalities, provincial treasuries, and national treasury as well. So that's very important, the clauses. Then on the next slide, the schedules set out the financial amounts allocated for each grant. They also set out the purpose. Just important to note that it's only the first year's money that is allocated in as definite. The outer 2 years are forward estimates or indicative allocations for the next 2 years. So that's the schedules. And the next slide. There are different types of schedules, 7 schedules to the Act. The first 3 contain the equitable share allocation, and then the back 4 from Schedule 4 onwards contain the conditional grants. So there are 2 types of sort of fairly similar direct conditional grants. Schedule 4 grants are supplementary grants, so this is where national government is making a contribution towards the fulfillment of a provincial function. And then Schedule 5 grants, which are a little bit more tightly run, have a little bit more restrictive conditions on them, and those are for specific programs that national government is funding provinces or municipalities to implement. And then Schedule 6 grants are a very different type of grant. In those grants, no funds are transferred to the province or municipality. The funds are retained with a national department or national entity and spent on behalf of, so in fulfillment of a local government or a provincial function, and any assets created through that need to be transferred to the province or municipality, but it's a very different type of grant. And then Schedule 7 grants, again, are a different type of grant. Those are funds that are available for emergencies, for declared disasters, and for housing emergencies, and so we don't... You'll see there are no allocations made to individual provinces or municipalities when we table the bill because we don't know where those disasters are going to happen. This is the only type of grant where we hope there will be no spending, because if there's no disaster, there's no need to spend it. They also allow for the rapid release of funding. So normally, you know, the rest of the bill is structured so that we have to table the allocations long in advance so that everyone can plan properly, et cetera, stability. We have to gazette the allocations, et cetera. Schedule 7 grants allow us to transfer the money first and then gazette the information about it later. So it's kind of the express lane, but very clearly, you know, you just be careful what you're using that for. And so it's limited only to those declared disasters and housing emergencies as defined in terms of the Housing Act. Then the explanatory memorandum gives a lot of detail. As I said, it's nearly 60 pages this year. It comes in 6 parts. The next few slides take you through the different parts. So on the next slide, the explanatory memorandum sets out the division of revenue. This is actually last year's division of revenue table from from W1. So it gives a description of all of the numbers, obviously. Then on the next slide, this kind of links back to the FFC presentation. The explanatory memorandum sets out in part one how all those constitutional requirements that the FFC presentation touched on are considered in and taken account of in the division of revenue. Part three of the explanatory memorandum then sets out government's response to the FFC recommendations that were tabled last year in Parliament, and then the parliamentary recommendations that your committee and others made at the end of last year aren't actually contained in this explanatory memorandum. They're contained in Annexure A to the budget review, and that's because they're grouped with the other parliamentary budget BRRs in that annexure. So that's how the bill takes account of those recommendations. Then on the next slide, very important, a lot of the space in W1 is taken up with detailed explanations, and you know, tomorrow we'll present a very high-level summary, but all of the detailed explanation of how the provincial equitable share and the local equitable share and the conditional grants are allocated is in Annexure W1. And we just thought we'd put up this particular table. Again, this is from last year's act, to highlight some of the useful information that's contained within the bill. So these are the learner numbers in schools in different provinces. And it's kind of an example that even if you're not just looking at it's not just the allocations, it's also the information that informs those allocations, and it can be useful, you know, if you're interested in whether there are more learners in Limpopo or the Eastern Cape. You know, these kind of tables, the information is in the Division of Revenue book, so it's not just the money. Then on the next slide, just a brief overview of how the provincial equitable share is determined. I think it was useful to touch a little bit on the content. So there are the 6 components, the largest of which is education, and that's based essentially on the proportion of learners in each province. Health component is based on a combination of the population that doesn't have access to medical aid, that doesn't have access to private facilities, and then data on hospital and clinic usage that is collected by each province. Obviously, this component will have to change at some point with NHI, but for now, this is the current system, right, that we're reflecting. The basic share makes up 16% of the equitable share formula, and that's based on population data. So it's often said that the equitable share formula is based on population data. It's actually only that basic share, the 16%, that is purely based on population data. There is a poverty component based on poverty rates in each province, which is worth 3%. There's an institutional component that allocates the same amount to each province. That's worth about 5%, and obviously that benefits smaller provinces, particularly the Northern Cape, Free State, and Northwest, and then economic activity component, which is worth about 1% of the formula, so quite a small component there. And then on the next slide, we just indicate the data for all of those components is updated annually with the most recent data, and that diagram on the left-hand side is a graphic representation of the population data from StatsSA that we use, and it's highlighting there, this example is for Gauteng, where migration happens. So it's often sort of in the public domain, it's often thought that we don't take account of migration, that we're not counting people. The mid-year estimates that StatsSA produces account for births and deaths in each province, but also the migration to each province. So you can see there the thickness of the lines shows how many, you know, the proportion of, the relative size, sorry, of people moving from each province. And you'll notice that the thickest line at the bottom there is people from outside of South Africa. So again, there's a popular misconception that the equitable share doesn't account for non-citizens or people who don't have ID books, etc. Those are very much in the estimates. and those population dynamics are accounted for as fully as we can. We also take account on the right-hand side there of the different age structures of each province, and it's just interesting to note in that example that the school-aged population in the Eastern Cape, for example, is much larger than the national average of, you know, in terms of the structure of the population pyramid there, which is why provinces like the Eastern Cape and KZN that have that age structure get relatively large equitable share allocations, larger than their population size would kind of indicate. And then on the next slide, we turn to the local government equitable share. So as fascinating as the data that's in the Annexure W1 for the provincial equitable share is, because there are 257 municipalities, we cannot possibly fit all the sort of same data in for the local government equitable share. And so what that sort of table that you can't read at the bottom there is an excerpt from the online version of the formula. So all of that same data, how many households there are, how many poor households in each municipality that inform the equitable share calculation is provided. It's just on our website. And so W1 contains a sort of text-based write-up of how the formula works. And then on the next slide, we give you an illustration of how that formula works, and I see the same basic diagram is in the Salga presentation. Essentially, though, there are two parts to the formula, 54 billion rand for free basic services, and that the cost of those is updated annually, and it provides allocations for 58% of South African households, so it's quite a wide subsidy there, and that number that it targets is updated annually as well. In other words, we take account of the growth in households. And then the other side of the formula on the right-hand side of the slide is funding for institutional and community services. And what's important about that is that those funds are only transferred to poorer municipalities. So City of Joburg, Cape Town, because they have a large own revenue base, we don't transfer any of that money to them, which allows us to transfer more to rural municipalities that have less own revenue. And so that's a very important feature of the structure of the formula to always highlight. Then on the next slide, Annexure W1 also gives an explanation of any of the changes in the structure of allocations to provinces and municipalities. So it will describe changes to individual conditional grants, to the equitable shares, where they are, etc., etc. I think we'll touch on that in more detail tomorrow when we do the actual content of this year's bill. Then the next slide then. So that leaves behind Annexure W1. Annexures W2 and W3 set out the conditional grant frameworks for provinces and municipalities respectively. So that's actually by page length, that's the longest section of the bill. And on the next slide, we give this is the sort of, each conditional grant framework has the same structure, and these are the headings of each of the different sections of the conditional grant framework. And highlighting there again two that are particularly key for oversight. The conditions section, so that usually stipulates what the grant can and can't be spent on. And then there's also a section on specifying specific responsibilities for the transferring officer and the receiving officer. These are, again, like the responsibilities in the bill clauses, but these are specific to that conditional grant that will, like, name the type of report that must be submitted and the date, etc., etc. And so when you're engaging with the department on what went wrong with the grant, you know, it can be quite useful to say, well, you say you don't know what the province was doing, but it says in the framework that they were supposed to submit this report to you by March. Did they do that? What did it say? You know, those are kind of useful things that you can do so that you're not in the dark about what should be, what the rules are and what the responsibilities are in this grant. On the next slide, we give you an example from the Math, Science and Technology grant. So an example of a condition that 40% of the grant must be used on maintenance of workshops. So if you're on an oversight visit and you see the workshops are dilapidated and they tell you, oh, well, no one gave us any money, you know, you can check that in the conditions. And there's an example of the kind of reports that must be submitted as well from the responsibility section. In the next slide, please. This just lists all of the things that are in the appendices, in the annexes and appendices, which is basically just a detailed breakdown of allocations. And there's some, you know, there's some things like EPWP targets that you might not know are there as well that can be useful, and project lists for some of the grants. On the next slide, though, we give you an example. So the last time I saw this committee, it's a pity the permanent delegate from the Western Cape has left. Last time I saw this committee was obviously with the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill, and then we went out on the provincial visits to present the bill there. I was in the Western Cape Provincial Legislature, and the chairperson there asked this question about having been on a recent visit to the oversight visit to Laingsburg Municipality and being told that no allocation was given to that municipality for electrification. And that kind of struck everyone as a little bit odd. And so I was, you know, trying to answer other questions and also flipping through the Division of Revenue Bill. And I see there that it's as clear as day that there's 2.3 million rand allocated in the Integrated National Electrification Program grant for Laingsburg Municipality. And if she had had that information when she was in the oversight visit, you know, she could have interrogated what went wrong here. You know, it says there was supposed to be an allocation. Did you submit the documents, the business plans that were required? Well, you know, why is this not being spent? You know, she would have had been in a much more informed position. So I think these kind of, when you look at them in the bill, they could look like a dizzying array of numbers. It's not easy to kind of, you can easily get lost in them. But when you have specific questions, if you know that the allocations are there, I think it can be very empowering for the committee when you are on those kind of oversight visits. And then I think I'm almost done here. On the next slide, we just have an example of one of the breakdowns of the components. So several conditional grants. The grant is, in this case, it's early childhood development, which by sheer coincidence, the chair of the FFC was talking about earlier. The early childhood development grant includes money for two different things, for maintenance and for subsidizing additional per child per day subsidies. And so there are two components, and if you want to know, so the schedule will only have the global amount for each province, but then the breakdown at the back of the book will show you how much for Gauteng is in each of those different components, and so that information is also available. And then on the next slide, we just show you that even though the bill is nearly 330 pages long, there is even more information that we couldn't fit in that is available on the Treasury's website. There's a Division of Revenue Bill portal there from the main budget page, and you can download this. A lot of the information in Excel format as well. For researchers is quite useful there. And then lastly, on the next slide, the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill. Just, I think this committee is familiar with it, having processed the bill last year, but just to make the point that it only makes amendments to that first column, to the allocations for the first year of the three-year MTEF period, and that we also use that opportunity to make any corrections to errors in conditional grant framework. And then my last slide, on the next one, is how the, just to make the point that it's sometimes a little bit strange that the Division of Revenue Bill, although we always talk about it in the context of the Money Bills and Related Matters Act, it's not technically a money bill. It doesn't technically appropriate money. It's a Section 76 bill that divides money between the three spheres of government. And the appropriation of those funds is then done in the budget of each of those three spheres. So in the appropriations bill that the committee considers later for national government, and then in the provincial budgets and the municipal budgets is where the money actually finally gets appropriated. Thank you, Chair. I'm going to hand over to Ohali or the seventh.
Thank you, Chair. Once a financial year starts, departments and authorities start reporting. So Section 32 and 40 of the PFMA and 71 of the NFMA emphasizes accountability
regular reporting and performance reporting on a monthly basis. And also, a division of revenue requires that there be monthly reporting on expenditure and revenue. Provincial departments submitting to provincial treasuries, national departments, and ultimate to the national treasury, but also the municipalities do submit to the provincial treasuries, and I think also to sector departments in terms of the grants that they get, and ultimately national departments have to submit quarterly reports to national treasury. But in terms of what we do have in-year monitoring reports, both for municipalities and for provincial departments, where we monitor expenditure performance. And on a quarterly basis, we do get performance reports, particularly for conditional grants that Stephen spoke about earlier. And in terms of conditional grants, there are processes that we follow after they submit this quarterly report. We have meetings with sector departments, which they'll call the other departments or municipalities which are not doing well, to discuss the reports. Part of what we do also in terms of monitoring, we do have provincial visits in terms of provinces, where we visit provinces, we sit with the different sectors. We have meetings with education, health, and human settlements, and transport, and others, where we discuss their performance. We normally do this in between from June up until August, this visit. But in terms of the municipalities one, it's called mid-year visit, where they do it mostly in January and February. So, and part of what we do also, I think on the mid-year visit, they'll also include infrastructure visits, to have a site visit to some infrastructure projects. So in terms of provincial side, what we do, we have been having this infrastructure visits separately, because we do have the reporting system called IRM, Infrastructure Reporting Model, that we also publish this information, as much as not required by the paper made section 32, that we do publish quarterly, but we have begun to publish also this spending on infrastructure on a quarterly basis. So based on this information from the IRM, we do infrastructure visit. And also we do have in-year reporting for public entities and also local government. So essentially this one just tells us what tools we have. I've already spoken about them. In terms of local government cycle, they have budget benchmarks where they determine whether municipalities have got funded budgets. They've got the budget verification processes. Media have already spoken about them, where they go assess where municipalities are in terms of implementation of their budgets. They write state of local government finances reports, their AG reports, section 71 reports are there in terms of municipalities. And then in terms of, in our case, provincial, we publish section 32 quarterly reports that will include infrastructure. And also there will be those reports for 138 and 140 triggers report that is published quarterly, and then there's a FMCMM, Financial Management Capability Mutual Model, which assesses where municipalities are. So from the provincial budget side, every December or January we do have meetings of provincial treasurers where they assess each province budget. We call them budget benchmarks. And then now, once we have done that, the expectation is that provinces will take recommendations into account when they finalize their budgets. And eventually they do table, the last four provinces tabled their budgets yesterday within the time prescribed by the legislation. So, and then we do have the visit as I indicated earlier, and then we do have monthly reporting. So in terms of what the legislation say is that on a monthly basis, there will be that provincial department submitting on the 15th to the national department, and the national department will submit to national treasury within 20 days. But essentially, I mean, we get this report twice, because when we get a report from that comes from provinces, it also includes conditional grants in it. So we get two reports from national department as national treasury, and also we should talk to each other, those two reports that we get. And on a quarterly basis also, they're expected to submit that financial to say what has the money bought that the departments had within 30 days to submit to national departments. And national departments consolidate that report of the 9 provinces for that particular grant and then submit to us. There's also expectation that once the financial year has ended, there must be annual evaluation of that particular grant to say what has happened. And then they submit the report to us as national treasurer. So we also see in terms of what the FECT has done with the money that we're given in that report. So essentially, in terms of financial, we check spending on a monthly basis, monthly and quarterly basis. We expect on average to be between 5%, but obviously in terms of infrastructure, we can expect that grants will be like that. And even in terms of, if you look at those who are in agriculture, they'll tell you about the time for planting seasons and so on. So each grant must be assessed individually, so we can't just say at this particular point in time and they should have spent that much. And we also check in terms of what money has been transferred to them. I think that's the kind of presentation we made last time to the committee about the percentage of funds transferred to the provinces, and also looking at the spending in entirety. So also, as I indicated, they do submit quarterly reports which we check in terms of where they are and what are the challenges. And most of the time we do have quarterly meetings with national departments. And in some instances, they would also invite provincial departments so that we can discuss the challenges that are within the sector with it.
Okay, so what we are reflecting here, which may not be very visible, is the work that we do in monitoring infrastructure, which I think would be quite interesting, because we have got a web-based system that captures every project that provinces do. So what we have here in this dashboard is really to show that we would have, we track the project, the name of the project, we track the location of the project, whether it's what district municipality it is, which is quite key in terms of this district model focus, and what local municipality it is, and where is that project, you know, in terms of progress. Is it 50% implementation? Is it, 20% implementation? Is it in planning stage? We also look at what is the source of funding, and what is it that project does? Is it about a new infrastructure, new school, maintenance, upgrading, and also who actually is implementing, you know, who is the implementing agent, and what is therefore the progress with regard to that project in terms of spending. So this can be quite an interesting information for oversight. So the next stage, the next reflect on how you can access this information. So the graph there just shows the active users per province that are also connected to the information, because the provinces have got to feed in information into the system. They have got also to use the information as part of analysis and management. Then we see the information. So what we are saying here is that we can make that system available to you, but we would have to train you specifically on how you can access the system. So we'll have to orientate you for maybe half a day, and then we can customize the information in terms of what you would like to see in your dashboard. So this is quite interesting for oversight, because what we have seen is that sometimes what they report, when you then pick up the project like you normally do, you say, okay, this project is at 20%, let's go and check. Sometimes you find that there is inconsistency. So you start asking questions. So I think for oversight, this is quite important. Yeah, so that provinces know that this information is being used, that they can provide accurate information, but also you'll be able to pick up funny things that are happening there. Okay.
Okay. Thanks, DDG, and thanks for the opportunity, Chairperson and honorable members. I'm going to continue by talking about the reporting framework for local government. This would be similar reporting framework that Okgali on the provincial side has already spoken about, but mine would zoom primarily on the on municipalities. We issue on a timeous basis the so-called Section 71, which would provide information for the state of municipal finances. This would highlight areas of risk that committee members should look into, or any warning system for the committee to look into. The framework measures performance that should be aligned with whether the performance is aligned with national priorities, and it promotes the principles of accountability and transparency, in a sense that we should publish this information, we make it available to everyone in the country, in fact to the whole world, because it's on our website, how municipalities are spending on a quarterly basis and what are they spending those monies on. It also allows for proactive management of the budget in relation to the actual performance. And what that means is that it allows for committee members to check whether municipalities are on track in terms of their performance in relation to what they budgeted for. Oftentimes, municipalities would adopt their budget on the basis of their projections on how to collect revenue, because unlike provinces, they are required to also raise revenue on their side in addition to the funding that they'll get from national government. Now, if they would have projected to collect a percentage amount and they collected less, that might be a hindrance to their ability to deliver service to their communities. The framework also enables stakeholders to structure policy that would benefit local government. FFC spoke quite a bit on that, to even when they begin to provide comments to in terms of the requirement in the constitution to look into such reporting, whether the allocations yield any results, and of course to comply with the legal framework. Next slide. As I've already indicated earlier on, the framework is informed by Section 71 and 72 of the Municipal Finance Management Act. Section 71 refers to monthly and quarterly reporting performances, and 72 talks about mid-year, half-year type of performance, where we are mid-year, and also annual type of performance and assessment. The framework also deals with just the third bullet, to make sure that it is committee members are aware of what was tabled in terms of the budget and what eventually councils adopted. In terms of MFMA, municipalities are required subsequent to the enactment of the Division of Revenue Bill to table their budget by the 31st of March. What that means is that they are then going to say to the communities, this is what we plan to do. They've got about 2 to 3 months to engage through public participation, and before the start of the financial year, which is July, then they must adopt those budgets. So the framework would deal with that mid-year. They are allowed in terms of MFMA and the Treasury regulation to adjust their budgets, and we continue throughout the year to monitor those budgets, whether they are aligned in terms of their performance. Next slide. Okay, just to zoom closely in terms of what the monthly reporting looks at, we basically assess the status of the budget on a monthly basis. These are also reports that municipal managers must table in council. So therefore, councillors are empowered. They should ask for those reports on a monthly basis, what's happening in their space. And what the DDG was also speaking about, this is aligned also in terms of infrastructure, to say this money that you are receiving, are you spending it on the right and the correct infrastructure policy imperatives and so on and so forth. And of course, all of this information is religiously sent to the National Treasury and to the Provincial Treasury, and ultimately on a quarterly basis we make this information available to various committees in Parliament. And my last slide, the heading there, it says what to look for in a publication. What is quite key in a municipal space is cash, liquidity. Most of our municipalities, they are not able to raise enough revenue on their side, and that leaves them with only what national can allocate, and ultimately conditional grants could be misused or are misused. So the framework provides for the cash position of municipalities to see where they are, if there are risks, and how liquid basically are they. You would hear that every now and then you would say a number of municipalities are practically bankrupt. Basically what we would say that we would be saying that we do not see how liquid they are if we look into their bank account, especially if they are not paying their creditors. Then we can clearly see this municipality is technically bankrupt. But these are issues that would require sort of half a day just to explain what is liquidity and what are some of the ratios. Of course, we look into the revenue trends. Some municipalities would keep cash in the bank, or if they don't have cash in the bank, and that's how they would not settle their debt. And if they may also keep cash in the bank, but yet they are not paying their creditors. So we are able to then say, as much as you have cash in the bank and you're not paying creditors, you're basically not liquid. The framework will also look into operational expenditures. This has got two faces. It's almost two faces of the coin. If you have an operational expenditure that is not moving, it does not mean that service delivery is being rolled out on the ground, because municipalities may not be implementing on the so-called repairs and maintenance, or they may also not be budgeting for it. So if the cash is there, it does not necessarily mean that they are doing well. But also if the cash is being spent, we need to also check what are they spending it against. And the first tool to assess is to look into the budget. What did you budget? How much did you budget for repairs, and how much did you budget for maintenance, and are you doing that? And where are those spaces where repairs and maintenance, as an example, is being spent on? Of course, the growth in credit in debtors and creditors also signals trouble, because it means that they are either not able to pay because they are not collecting, or they are utilizing money for other things than what they are supposed to. In terms of sorting out their obligations. The reporting framework also focuses on external loans. Are they servicing their loans? Are they fundable? Are these loans assisting them to grow their balance sheet? Are they growing their assets, which would also help them to grow their economies? So just to cut the Honourable Chairperson, basically this is to say that these are some of the questions to say to municipalities, to say, look, how much is your budget? Where are you mid-year? Are you doing what you said you would do? Oftentimes we experience that they shift the goalposts. The project that they started the year with is not being implemented on. They would create new plans. And once you create new plans mid-year, in the year, you will not spend the money. Next slide. Should I hand over to Mark?
Okay, so this is the last one. So we thought we might just throw in this one, because this is about when the subnational has failed. We are reflecting here that the constitution and the legislative framework provides for intervention. So on the case of provincial level, so when there is a failure and financial crisis in a province, Section 100 of the Constitution, which can come in the form of a national directive may be issued, or if there's a really serious crisis, national executive can go further and take over. And we have this in Northwest, which is the only province now that is still under intervention. So, but the provincial treasurers also are required to exercise control in the implementation of the budget, and sometimes they do also provide support and some form of intervention in the department if there's a serious problem with how they're managing their finances. So with regard to local government, Section 154 of the Constitution, as we know, provides for national and provincial to provide capacity support, which is a, there is a lot of it that actually has been provided, and I think we spend almost like $3 billion a year in terms of various capacity building programs. But I suppose you would say, are they effective? And I think that's the question that we're asking ourselves, given that more and more of municipalities are getting into a financial crisis. And Section 139 provides for three instances in which the province can intervene, and if the province fails in terms of Section 1395, then the national government can intervene. So the three instances, if the municipality is found here failing in executing its obligations, executive obligations, in terms of Section 1391, the province can intervene and even dissolve the council, if that is the case. I think that is what they are trying to do in Swanee, because of some of the challenges that seem to be there. And then, or if the municipality fail to, if the municipality is in financial crisis, then you have got Section 1395, which becomes a mandatory intervention that in a way gets left from the financial side, because you need the financial recovery plan that has to be prepared through us. So, or if the municipality fails to table the budget and revenue raising measures, so there are interventions. And we have looked at why this thing fails, and we realize that it's not about, not so much about shortfall in the legislation, it's really about you know, the will to implement in the correct way, and maybe the capacity actually to implement in the correct way so that we can get the right results. And then I think we are working towards seeing how we can improve on how we are actually implementing the legislation for impact that we want. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Very interesting, very empowering. How I wish we had more time. And I think I'm not the only one enjoying this. Can I quickly go to Salga before I give members to come in? And I know for me and Honorable Karim, we have pressure. We'll sort it among ourselves.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning to honorable members.
Can I just explain what it is, what pressure? Because we've invited people here, in fairness to them. After we invited people, well, the chair did, we were told that all chairpersons in both houses have to meet at 12:30 to 2. So I have to choose myself. I'm at 12:30. And I think the chair needs to round up. But I just think it's fairness for the chair.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning to honorable members. I'm Councillor T.N. Charles, NCOP rep for SALGA, representing Mpumalanga. I'm not alone. I'm with my worker or co-worker or official, let me put it that way, Mr. Mohamed Lohat. He's a municipal finance specialist. I will request him to do the presentation for SALGA strategy and plans 2017-2022. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Member. Can we go one slide back? Backwards. One more. Yeah, thank you. So just before we start, quickly, just to take you through in terms of the SALGA strategy. SALGA, our mandate is premised on six broad aspects. So the one aspect is the issue of lobbying, advocacy and representation. We also employ a representation body. We also do capacity building for our members, support and advice, strategic profiling and knowledge and information sharing. And we cluster these six mandates broadly into three broad goals. I'm not going to go through all of this in detail, but it's quite self-explanatory in terms of what we're doing there. And based on that, we actually then fulfill our functions and do our functions and activities as SALDA. So if you go to the next slide. In terms of the fiscal policy space specifically, the scope of work that we do in the fiscal policy space is mainly aimed at two broad overall objectives. The first one is the issue of the local government fiscal architecture and looking at the funding for local government. And then the second one is the issue of support to municipalities with regards to revenue management and the issues of debts owed to municipalities and owed by municipalities. And if you go over to the next slide, our position on the division of revenue and local government fiscal architecture is documented on an annual basis through various platforms. And these are the platforms that we interact with as a SALDA. So we have what we call the winter and spring budget forum meetings. We've got technical budget forum meetings as well. And as SALDA is also presenting our views on different parliamentary committees after the minister does his budget policy statement, the medium-term one, and the actual table budget itself. And those are just all the different committees that we interact with as SALDA as well. I think some of these items have been covered by the previous two presentations as well, Chair, so I'm not going to take a lot of time on in terms of those things. But just in terms of the way SALDA actually gets our mandate or our mandating process specifically, positions are canvassed from our member municipalities through our provincial working groups, and then the merits of these are tested and selected proposals are further researched to provide necessary empirical evidence. These are then tested and fed back at our provincial and national working groups, and ultimately endorsed by SALDA, CEC, and NEC. And once this is then done, then our policies start to be considered to be official, and that's what we take forward as a SALDA viewpoint. In the current financial year, we've commissioned a study on the local government, a review on local government equitable share and fiscal architecture, and this was basically our basis for consultation, where we're pushing for an increased funding dispensation for local government. So, if you go over to the next slide, SALDA's position in terms of the division of revenue at an overall level is that we are proposing or we are actually advocating that local government is underfunded currently, even in the current 2020 division of revenue bill. The white paper on local government from 1998 envisages a situation of long-term equilibrium facilitated by the notion of equitable share. So what we're saying is that in a municipality where there was going to be a deficit or it was going to be a shortfall, this would be supplemented by government transfer. Now, we note on the Treasury presentation and other presentations as well, where they mentioned that municipalities and local government have the powers to raise own revenue, which is 100% correct. It is there, and municipalities do that as well. The challenge, unfortunately, is in terms of collecting that revenue. And that's where the challenge has been for the last number of years, and is unfortunately getting worse over time. So, just to focus maybe the final part at the bottom over there, we believe that local government in aggregate has in fact been in a long-term state of disequilibrium due to the mismatch of the assumptions of the white paper in terms of local government's own revenue-raising ability and its steady increase in the functions of local government. And also with regards to the cost of providing the services and the rising household poverty as well, which is contributing to that further disequilibrium in the local government sphere. So if we can go over to the next slide. The current realities in terms of local government owned revenue sources and the dependence on local government equitable share. The own revenue that we're actually collecting, both potentially and actual, falls far short of the assumptions of the white paper. Most municipalities are nowhere close to funding 90% of OPEX through own revenue. And this is one of the fundamental actually assumptions in terms of the white paper itself. The relative share as of and respective value of service charges also differs from the assumptions made in the white paper. And one of the most outstanding features here is the contribution of electricity. Even as ESCOM supplies electricity to 50% of households, despite Commission representation made a point about it as well. And unfortunately, the reality is that in many municipal areas, what we find is in the municipal jurisdiction, those areas are directly supplied by ESCOM. For the other services that are provided by the municipality, the collection rate in those areas are much lower versus areas that are supplied with a full basket of services, including electricity, in those areas as well. And this obviously contributes to the low collection rates that municipalities have as well. The issue of the rising debtors book owed to municipalities, which is 164 billion, the latest Section 71 report for Q2, that figure has gone up to approximately 182 billion as well. So those figures are rising steadily. The other one we want to focus on as well is, unfortunately, there is also a proportion of debt owed to municipalities by other organs of state as well. And that figure of 12 billion is also going upwards. So in the Q2 numbers, it's also quite higher compared to what it was in Q1 as well. So we can move over as well. This slide is very much similar to what Treasury presented in terms of the local carbon equitable share. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but what we're trying to emphasize in terms of this is that Treasury has based their cost of their local government equitable share on this model, with the basic services component, the institutional component, and the community services component, and they've indicated that it's based on to provide it to households, I think with two months of old age grant, so that qualified for it, etc. But what we're trying to show in essence in this specific slide is to indicate that the actual cost of services that are provided by municipalities versus what is given by the equitable share, there isn't currently a match between the two. So the costs are actually much higher than what is actually provided for in terms of the actual equitable share formula itself. So if you move over to the next slide, SALGA's relationship with the FSD, there was a costing model developed to improve the local government equitable share. So in terms of the costing model that has been developed, comprehensive municipal specific profiling was done. The cost of municipal basic services can be moderated individually, per category or in total. And also it needs to take into consideration other factors such as the spatial characteristics, topography and geology of the area itself. The ability to establish the cost of municipal services based on actual costs, benchmark cost, average cost, or some combination of these. And the model also allows for temporal adjustments to variable-based data sets. For example, the issue of population size and the number of households. The model discourages municipal inefficiencies. So the FSC and SALGA would therefore approach the adequacy or inadequacy of the equitable share by assessing the implications of the cost of basic services model on the local government equitable share, and it's assessing the gap between the current provision and the local government equitable share that would be driven by the new basic cost. Incorporating some facets of the model into the local government equitable share at large as well. This will actually assist us in confirming the adequacy or inadequacy of the local government equitable share, both vertically and horizontally as well. So if you go to the next slide as well, one of the things we also then focus on from a SALGA perspective is the issue regarding the water tariff, and in the water tariff increases that water boards have been proposing. And SALGA was part of those deliberations. And if you look at the different water boards and what they proposed, most of the recommendations were not supported. There was only one that was supported, and the one from Rand Water, the tariff proposal, was supported because the effect of this was, if the water boards increase their tariffs to the municipality, obviously they have to increase or pass on those increased charges to customers as well. And already the collection rate on water itself as a service from municipalities is quite low. So obviously having further increases may not be sustainable or will actually add to the sustainability issues that they are currently facing as well. Okay, can you move on? So what we are saying is, in terms of how can we actually fill this gap or try and close this gap of local government. So we are saying from a local government perspective, it can be filled by a combination of a high allocation of nationally raised revenue to local government, restructuring conditional grants to be more flexible and to cover an element of maintenance, And I think it was actually welcomed in the Minister of Finance's budget speech, where he indicated going forward, the local government municipal infrastructure grant will have a portion that will be assisting for maintenance as well, and look forward to that. The review of municipal demarcation to focus on financial viability, the concerted campaign to reduce distribution losses, the national incentive to enforce commercial customers to settle their debt, the reduction of the reporting or compliance burden, removing ESCOM from the municipal electricity distribution market, because constitutionally they should not be there in any case, addressing confusion over the respective powers and functions between local government and other parts of government or other spheres of government, and requiring other parts of government to settle their accounts, so intergovernmental debts to be settled and to pay their accounts timely. Then just the last point on this specific area regarding the fiscal architecture is that, the next slide, is that SALGA has lobbied for a long time to have a dedicated session with the Minister of Finance in terms of local government issues. So one of the realities is that when you have the budget forum meeting, the budget forum deals with budget matters, for the entire country. And local government is given just a small portion of time and a very small portion in terms of the actual agenda itself. So we were actually fortunate that in the last budget forum, the Minister of Finance has actually agreed to a session, a budget forum, the Khotla, which will be focused on local government issues. And the idea is this will take place sometime in May or June. And then SALGA, together with Treasury, COCA and the FFC, is going to put together an agenda which will focus on local government issues. And this is what we're talking about, just in terms of the topics for consideration that will be discussed at that actual budget forum, the Khotla itself. Okay, then if you move over to the next one, target number 36, which is the issue in participating in revenue and debt management structures. So SALGA is an active member of the National Revenue Steering Committee, which is looking at developing integrated revenue frameworks between SALGA, COCTA, Treasury, and the provincial counterpart. And the whole idea about this is to see how can we actually improve in terms of revenue management in the local government sphere itself. We are also participating on the Interministerial Task Team on Debt, the IMTT. And this was dealing obviously with the issue of the debts owed to ESCOM and the water boards. And SALGA has been part of that. And obviously we understand that there's a big drive in government that they want to get the ESCOM debt to be paid. And SALGA is obviously also assisting in this regard and trying to make sure that our municipalities do pay where they can pay, but there's also a number of issues that we need to deal with from a constitutional point of view with regards to ESCOM as well. If you can go over to the next page, the National Intergovernmental Debt Forum, which looks at the issue of intergovernmental debt that's owed to municipalities. So there's been some action taken there, but I don't think it's been done effectively and quickly enough. So there's still, as I mentioned, the amount owed by other government departments or other spheres of government to local government is actually increasing over time. So the numbers are getting higher and higher. The other one is the SARS database exchange project, where SALGA is actually looking where we can look at enhancing and cleansing of data for revenue purposes. So within the information that we have at municipalities to see whether we can refine and cleanse them based on information that SARS has on the actual taxpayers and where they are living, etc. The next one, the budget benchmarking suitability assessment, SALGA participates in those as well, and we also find value in terms of that because we get a good sense in terms of the municipalities whether they are actually meeting the requirements, spending appropriately, etc. or not. And also we identify as an early warning system where some of the challenges may be. We also participate in ad hoc revenue management awareness and training. And then SALGA has also done some research and legal opinion specifically on various specific topics as well. So that concludes the first part of the fiscal policy. We're now going to move over to the second part, which looks at the issue of the municipal audit support program of SALGA. But we're going to try and focus specifically on the MSCOA. We were asked to look at the municipal senate chart of accounts and what work SALGA is doing in terms of that. So the couple of slides here just talks about the municipal audit support program. I'm just going to go through very briefly. The audit support program is premised on four broad pillars, which is leadership, governance, institutional capacity, and financial management. And what handling effectively in a municipality, then the municipality's audit outcomes should be able to improve and get better over time. Some of the key or emerging risks that we've identified from the Auditor General's report is the issue of non-compliance with SCM policies and regulations, giving rise to high levels of UI, unauthorized irregular interest and wasteful expenditure. There's some challenges with regards to recourse management in local government itself. There's poor to no consequence management and accountability in a number of municipalities. The Municipal Standard of Accounts, the MSCOA implementation, is still currently a key risk in local government itself. And financial health indicators, which are basically, you know, manifesting themselves in terms of unfunded budgets passed by municipalities, debt owed to municipalities which are getting higher over time, debt owed by municipalities to ESCOM and the water board. And if I may put it this way, the number one risk facing local government, if you were to do a risk register, would be this issue of local, of financial health of local government itself. And the last one is what we call the MSME non-compliance. We can skip the slide, but these are some of the provinces that have the highest proportion of poor audit outcomes. And then the finding of specific risk area, which is basically that the AG has identified, is the quality of performance reports. Majority of municipalities have repeat findings on supply chain management and asset management, and then the financial health of municipalities has been deteriorating over the last few years as well. We can skip the next one as well. This is in terms of how the actual math is done. That's just for information purposes. In terms of the math delivery model, we focus on three broad principles, which looks at capacity building, hands-on support, advocacy profiling, and lobbying. And below that, we indicate what the different activities the SALGA has been, you know, has been doing in terms of those three broad areas as well. And another thing to maybe look at into the next slide is that the issue of audit support and support to municipalities in general is something that is done by many stakeholders. And SALGA acknowledges that, and we try and work as far as possible in a collaborative manner with other stakeholders as well, so we can try and get the efficient and effective support to the municipalities out there. So coming to the specific area of MSCOA, the Municipal Standard Chart of Accounts was a reform that was introduced by National Treasury, and it's driven by them as well, and they take the lead in terms of actually implementing the reform out there. So in terms of the actual implementation date, 1st of July 2017, municipalities were required to actually start implementing the MSCOA itself. And the latest figures we have in terms of implementation is, I think, there's between an 85 to 90% compliance rate in terms of the MSCOA implementation. So municipalities are submitting data streams, doing what they need to do, etc. But the one thing we picked up, which we wanted to raise, we never put it specifically on this slide, but the one challenge that we have, and something we've raised with Treasury as well, is that there's a heavy reliance on service providers that the municipalities have contracted with for the implementation of MSCOA. And the way that they are basically submitting the data streams on a monthly basis and getting the required reports from National Treasury is with the assistance of those service providers. If those service providers have to pull out of the municipalities tomorrow, the whole MSCOA compliance rate would deteriorate significantly. So there's unfortunately a very big reliance on those service providers as we speak till now. And many municipalities are not running these systems on their own. They can't. They don't actually have the skills and ability to do it. And in some cases, municipalities are also transacting out of the system. And then they get the actual service provider to come in and then assist them in getting the reports of Treasury. So on the Treasury side, they can see the data streams are being submitted, but in reality, the system isn't being used effectively as it should be. So there's still a challenge with regards to the MSCOA. And from a SALGA perspective, the stance we've taken is that we understand the objectives of this. If the system is going to be working well, it will assist municipalities significantly because they'll be able to plan, budget, transact, and report from the system directly. And obviously, that's the first prize we would like that to be there. But the challenge that we face is that municipalities, in terms of implementing the system currently, are still struggling. And that is a challenge that we are facing. So moving over to the issue of municipal infrastructure grants. The issue of municipalities relying on infrastructure grants is something that's been there and it's always going to be there. It's one of the key sources of their funding. The challenge that we're having, unfortunately, municipalities, if you go to the next slide, is that their own revenue sources and infrastructure grants are not sufficient to cover the current expenditure needs, capital expenditure needs. A big portion of capital expenditure is financed from grant transfer. Borrowings make a very small portion of the capital expenditure itself. The challenge that we are facing is that a number of infrastructure grants that have been growing over the last 12 years or past 12 years are now envisioned to gradually decline. So in the latest budget speech itself, for example, one of the grants, the public transport network grant and urban settlement grant, are going to be reduced, and MIG, with an amount of approximately 2.8 billion rand, that's been earmarked for that. So that's obviously something that we've noted and flagged, and we say that it's a potential concern because it's going to be going down. So if you go to the next page, infrastructure grants, the point we wanted to raise here is that conditions imposed on municipalities in terms of how they spend their grants are very rigid. So we've been advocating for the consolidation of grants, fewer reporting lines, and more flexibility to explore innovation when planning for CapEx. Greater freedom to prioritize green infrastructure and respond to sectoral changes is what we are providing or proposing. And we also support legislative reforms by central government to reduce red tape around pledging of infrastructure grants to augment climate finance. Training to make effective use of this reform is being provided to municipalities. And then we also support, as I mentioned, the Minister of Finance's pronouncement in his budget speech to allocate grants or a portion of grants to prioritize asset management and infrastructure maintenance as well. So the issue of infrastructure grants towards the climate change agenda, the conditions of infrastructure grants currently limit the ability of municipalities to respond to climate change programs. They should make, we are proposing that infrastructure grants should make provisions for capital expenditure on environmental functions with climate benefits. And grant conditions for development in high-emitting sectors should have requisite conditions for greenhouse gas measurements, tracking, and reductions. And in the maintenance of infrastructure and assets, there's a huge deficit or funding deficits for maintenance, rehabilitation, and renewal. And this obviously exacerbates the risk of the impact of climate change as well. So, what are the current realities in terms of conditional grants and the difficulty to spend? So, conditional grants, as we know, if they're not spent, they are reduced, and in many cases, the reduction is due to underspending of municipalities. The current structure of the grant is counterproductive. It is costly, particularly for smaller municipalities, to administer. The unpredictability of funding and the withdrawal of grants as a punitive measure to municipalities is not helping as well. It fails to actually address the actual needs in municipalities. And this is in direct conflict with the basic assumptions behind decentralization. Infrastructure dynamics have changed since 1998, and the focus has to be now on maintenance and not only on new builds only. Poor maintenance is creating a huge contingent liability and also undermining the revenue model through growing distribution losses and disincentivizing account payments. There's also an element of fiscal dumping that takes place on local government. And then capacity building failures by national and provincial government, where the Safety 154 objectives aren't always promoted and facilitated appropriately. So if you go to the next page as well, if you look at the reasons for the poor infrastructure grant spending between the environmental and institutional reasons as well. At an environmental level, there are sometimes community disruptions of projects, the informal business chambers, sometimes hijack projects itself, and that's linked also with the issue of the 30% subcontracting that the triple PFA requires, where you get sometimes situations where projects cannot continue until the 30% is dedicated to a specific person or persons in the municipal area, and then also issues of land rights contestations have an impact as well. From an institutional point of view, some of the challenges that are faced by municipalities is lack of project preparation capabilities, poor contract management, misalignment of planning and procurement processes, and ability to cash back rollover applications. One of the things that we would ideally like is that when municipalities start a new financial year, they have shovel-ready projects. So when the money is given to them, they can go ahead and start actually implementing. The reality is that due to the lack of those technical skills, many of them cannot do those, are not in that position as well. So maybe just our last slide. What are we actually trying to do to improve grant performance infrastructure grant for former municipalities. If we are designing an infrastructure grant oversight ministry for councillors to have better oversight of grant spending. Obviously, we know there's a Section 71 report that day as well, so councillors need to utilize it more effectively as well. We plan to workshop councillors on asset management readiness scales in terms of 5 competency areas in order to promote sustainable service delivery driven by competent infrastructure asset choices. Continue to lobby and to advocate at policy level for conditions of infrastructure grants that are more flexible in promoting efficient and value for money capital expenditure. Guide councillors into embedding climate change responses into the infrastructure program as outlined in their integrated development plan. And then roll out project preparation training for a project management unit of municipalities. And we try to facilitate that together with MISA itself. So we can have, as I mentioned, the shovel-ready projects when the new financial year starts. So in conclusion, we just say that local government is everybody's business. If it works, the country works. If it doesn't work, then the country is in chaos, effectively. And we obviously need your support and assistance in order to make this work. Thank you.
Thank you very much. For all the presentations, I'm now going to give members an opportunity to talk to the presentations, and hopefully we will also mind the time. But my apologies that I have to give you so much time, so little time for you to interact with the information session. Honorable Kiva and Honorable Ryder.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me first rise to welcome the presentations, which are quite enriching, quite very helpful for our work, and also for us to be able to see the relationship between the three institutions that are presenting before us. Well, I would have loved that we were to have enough time to engage, because this information is quite empowering. And a few hours, 2 hours, 3 hours is not enough for this. I don't know if, Chairperson, it is possible that we can get a serious workshop wherein we can really have enough time to engage beyond the leaders of delegation that are here present. Perhaps if they can delegate further people so that we can, through a fine call, go through this. Because what has been presented to us are the instruments which are going to help us to navigate the next 4 years as we do our work. That's the first thing that I want to do. You know, the other thing, Chair, which is difficult for someone like me who thinks in this course, is that when these presentations are made in English, much as I am able to understand to some extent, but I would like to have an understanding to a greater extent what is being presented to us. Because I can have the understanding that I have here, but for my constituency, I want to break down this into simple language and the concepts and the terminology which is used, if it can be made available, the whole presentation. Others who don't, also others who have English as their fifth language, can have the same benefit. So, good professor, this document, it can be emailed to me in a closer version in a day or two, I would appreciate. And also, Chair, I really don't have questions of clarity, because if I were to start with those questions today, given the fact that we are left only with 5 minutes before we have to dash to prepare for the House sitting. So the engagement that I'm asking for can allow us to ask really those questions of clarity where there were areas which were not quite clear. So with those few words, I want to thank all the presenters for this valuable information, and I'm happy that the delegations themselves are held at a high level by the leadership. and the interlinking of the three presentations is obvious and apparent, and I think we needed all three here today in order to do this, but the time is insufficient. I'm going to make some comments. Some are aimed at only one presentation, but most go across the board. I was pleased the FFC had the first bite of the cherry today. They normally go after the PBO, and the PBO takes all of their time, and they left with none, so I'm pleased that they went first. Anyway, just some comments that I wanted to make. Just the professor. So, yes, I think that there was much emphasis in the first half of the presentation about the legislation and the fact that there's a lot of musts in the legislation, and Treasury must listen, and Treasury must review, and must take note, and must consider. And I think that the emphasis again is perhaps a repeat of the previous comments that Treasury is not showing that they are mustering enough. Okay, they're not mustering themselves sufficiently to give attention to the recommendations of the FFC. And I think the FFC, you know, the Treasury will have their own opinion in that, and I'm sure they will differ with me, Stephen. I'm sure they will differ, but the reality is that there's consultation required. And I'd like to think that the budget Lakhotla, budget forum Lakhotla that's been held, is partly emanating out of the discussions that came out of this committee during the course of last year. So I welcome that as well. But I do think that the FFC is emphasizing the fact that they're feeling like they are working without getting proper acknowledgement. Just moving on to some comments about the district model. Can we afford 257 municipalities, etc., etc.? My concern, and perhaps it's just to highlight it for the FFC going forward, is that the district model can't be implemented and certainly shouldn't be implemented in a one-size-fits-all approach. For example, the way a district operates in the Eastern Cape and the way a district operates in Gauteng is very, very, very different because the requirements of the locals are very, very, very different. So if the FFC can perhaps keep that in mind maybe help support my case going forward. You spoke as well about the fact that you happened to mention Mpuleni, which is my constituency, so that's close to my heart, okay? And you mentioned, in the same breath, you indicated that many municipalities sit with no fiscal base. The truth is, Mpuleni has a strong fiscal base. They just don't know how to extract the money out of it. They have no billing system. They have no consistency. And honestly, it's poor management in Mpuleni that has left them to where they are now. But the point that I wanted to make here is that poor management. So Salga, again, now I'm talking to all three presentations. Salga's claiming they're underfunded. The FFC's previous document indicated that local government is underfunded. Treasury disagreed last time and said no, they believe local government has got sufficient ability to raise their own funding, etc. So there's a need for the Lakhotla, but the reality is that until local government is prepared to step up to the plate and start managing themselves correctly, I think they will continue to be underfunded because they show no ability to deal with the money that they're given. Okay. Having said that, the problem is that, again, you can't treat all local municipalities the same. You have got, I think, 18 clean audits across the country, and you've got a whole bunch of unqualifieds. Those municipalities should be reasonably rewarded for using their funding correctly. The costing of legislation, I found, was an incredibly interesting point. The fact that we really need to consider costing legislation. Included in that, by the way, is MSCOA and the rollout of MSCOA. And I'd like to ask, and this is one of the big questions I'd like to ask, is the cost-benefit of MSCOA to Treasury. I know that Treasury hasn't fielded most of the costs. The locals have, or the municipalities have fielded the costs. But has there been a benefit to MSCOA yet? I know it was designed to reduce corruption, to extract value for money, etc., etc. Are we seeing that, or is it just something that The next thing I want to move on to his presentation the issue around fiscal dumping, and the words were thrown in earlier, but the fact with DORA, in last week, not last week, the week before, National Gazette, the Government Gazette, the Minister took a whole lot of money away for housing from Gauteng, Free State, etc., and allocated it to the Western Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, etc., etc. It was quite a substantial amount, and it undermined, I believe, DORA. My questions around it are numerous. One is there any consultation? I doubt it, because it's a set of the Z. Number two, is there an adjustment made for that in the following financial year? So does the forfeiting province get a bigger allocation next year and the receiving province get slightly less? How is that handled, or is it just lost? And then, yeah. So I had a number of calls after the budget speech from municipalities saying, how much do we get, Dennis? How much do we get? And it's incredibly difficult from the DORA document because you've got this section and then that section and then the next section. Is there anywhere that you can point me to find how much an individual municipality gets? That will be extremely useful to me. And the same, of course, for a province, because I think that then works. And then a breakdown per municipality of this is what you're getting overall would be extremely useful. Solga, I think that I note that you are part of the budget forum, always have been. I'll be very short, Jay, I understand. Yeah, they were given 40 minutes each. Cool. They're not going to get the response in, unfortunately. Okay, so you're part of the budget forum. Yeah, I would like to get a report back, certainly from the budget forum, the Khotla, how we're moving forward. Then on project hijacking, you spoke about it and the difficulties you have with spending. The fact is that is a legacy of Mr. Zuma. Mr. Ramaphosa has fortunately come out strongly against that in his budget speech and spoken about illegitimate business policies.
Honourable Raila, will you not please offer us and just speak to the presentation? Don't take us there.
Mr. Ramaphosa dealt with it directly in his budget.
Don't take us there. Whose fault was it for whatever? Let's focus on the presentation.
Part of the presentation, but fair enough, I'll take your lead. The question is how to implement that, and I think that's a problem that Salga needs to get. How to now unroll that 30% issue practically? When it happens, what steps must municipalities take? I don't have that answer. I think Salga needs to roll out something so that municipalities are empowered. And then, again, slides are not numbered, so it makes it difficult to refer. Salga, we've asked this before from you. But you spoke about the unpredictability of funding and the withdrawal of grants to punish municipalities. I don't believe that that's a reality. I don't think punish is right. I think that's quite a bold or bold statement. If you think that that is what's happening, perhaps it's to punish for mismanagement or lack of planning. But if you've got other things, please by all means bring it to our attention where municipalities are being unfairly punished. Let us know what those are. I will close with that, Chair. There's lots more I could say.
Honourable members, when I opened the meeting, I requested that we must not do the oversight and pose oversight questions. The session today was for capacity building, and the reason why these three institutions are here is to assist us and empower us in terms of our oversight role, which sections, where do we get our powers, how to access information, how to dig information and empower ourselves as we do our oversight. So I know it's a thin line between, it's very difficult for us as a public representatives to can speak to you without asking questions because of the frustrations that we are experiencing at our constituency level.
But I'm going to appeal that you speak to, because we don't have much. I have another meeting also that I must attend to, ethics committee. So it's very important committee, you must know. So I want you to comment the three presenters. And there's also a comment that came from Honorable Mkiva to say we need more time. And I'm agreeing with him, but that can be made possible depending on the availability of members. So I think amongst ourselves, we need to communicate and when we come back to see how we can make more time for us to do this, because this should be a continuous thing, this interaction, because it can't be an event today and think that everything is covered. I see your hand, Honorable Stuart. Yes?
Thank you, Chair. I'll be brief. I just want to thank the presentations, appreciate the presentations of all three the people, everyone that presented. I also value the National Treasury's website. I believe that we can benefit from that, we as members and councillors alike, and that I'd like to support the Honourable Ryder with regards to the breakdown of DORA municipalities as well as provinces. But thank you so much for your time.
Okay, you wanted to support. Okay. I will give FFC to comment, then Treasury and Ansaura. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. Chair, I think I would just make two points. One is that I think it would be great if we can get another opportunity after the confines of the time constraints of during the week, you know, so that there are just more things to discuss other than the way we've done the presentations from our perspective. And in that, there are two parts to it. There's probably a need going forward to look at national and provinces as a discussion, and then national, provinces and local government as a discussion, so that you put the focus on local government on the second one, and put the focus on provinces on the second one, because these two are ostensibly the focus areas of the NCOP. So that would be my suggestion, because there are multiple relationships, but the relationships around 1-2 and then 1-2-3 to look at. That was the first point I thought was important, and I mean, our job is to interact regularly with Parliament. That's all we do. That's our job, and then to interact with Treasury and then the provinces, etc. So we are available. The second thing, just a short thing, is that I think the district model and the discussion is an open debate. And here's a key thing that I think members must be aware of, that one of the key policy changes that's going to happen, there's going to be on the social side, on the governance side, and the financing side, it's going to be the NHI. It's going to change the way we look at. Like social grants has done, remember the moving of SASA, establishment, and change how provinces function, etc. The NHI is going to do the same. So there is a need to have that conversation, because it gets into the provincial role, it gets into a new national role, it gets into the identification of the financing for health. So Honourable Ryder and Common and members, I think it's an important thing to look at. But I think what is critical for me, my last point, is that when I raise the issue of capacity, it cuts across everything. Because to have financial capabilities is a form of capacity. To have the right set of staff is a form of capacity. To have the right institutional systems in place is a form of capacity. To have the right set of rules approved, because we're a rule-based country, the rule of law is capacity. So there's a range of things. So I myself, and we have discussions in FFC, I also don't believe in the one-size-fits-all. I think one-size-fits-all was necessary 10, 15 years ago. Now we have to relook at this once I said more. And that's why I agree, I don't know what the President's content is, but the President has raised the reorganization of the state. And we're looking forward to that, because that will probably also be another way of looking at it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the comment. I think the one I'd like to point towards is because what we normally do is to issue allocation letters to each municipality that outline their allocation. So maybe what we will have to consider how we can make that more visible. Maybe the website or something like that. But I think it's something that we will consider. But we do have that picture between ourselves. On the issue of reallocation on HNDC, actually, in terms of the law, it is actually Treasury that stops and reallocates, but it's usually on the recommendation of the National Department. So when the National Department says, I would like to stop and reallocate, we run a process that convinces us that indeed there is an underperformance, and then we get that the changes. So there is consultation, and the process actually demands a huge amount of consultation with the department or with the municipality that is being affected. So the allocations for next year don't normally get affected by what we do in the current year, because one always assumes that if you feel the pain of losing the money, then you will do the things that you wish to do to make sure that you don't lose next year. So we don't punish the department or municipality in the next year necessarily just because they couldn't spend in the current year. MSCOA, you know, I think maybe it's something that we can have a more discussion in terms of our assessment of where we are with MSCOA. So he acknowledged that MSCOA is quite a big reform, business process reform, that at the end of the day will really make local government work much more efficiently and reduce even the effort in terms of your reporting, you know, and linking those plans and budget and reports. So I think the benefit at the end of this journey would be quite tremendous. But we are in a journey, and we didn't expect that it would, as a reform, it would suddenly happen in a year or so. So we believe that we are still in our time frame in terms of how we expected the reforms actually to unfold and to be institutionalized. So there is a process. Hence, we are still putting resources to support municipalities to be able to make sure that they do that. Obviously, we get caught up sometimes in the municipalities that are also dysfunctional in terms of their own capacity, which often capacity in municipalities sometimes is not something that they inflict upon themselves by hiring wrong people, because we find that there is a lot of people there but they don't have the right skills. So I think we get caught up in that, but we are making an offer to all the stakeholders that we are putting in to make sure that we can achieve it. And we're determined that we will get there, and then it's going to really make local government much very much better. Yeah.
So thank you, Chair. Thank you for the comments, sir. Yeah, I think the issue of the 30% one, yes, we will look at doing guidance for our members. I think obviously something that impacts them, and where we can improve with regards to you know, trying to deal with the issue, then we definitely will give some guidance in terms of that. The issue of the withdrawal of the grants, yeah, it's something that's unfortunate. I mean, there's a number of reasons why it happened, but it's something that SAGA will also then consider, and if this report or if this information is required, we can do this as well. Yeah, I think that was about it from all of the
chair. Thank you very much for the comment. And I will request to Roma, can you make the announcement or the comment, then close what you made.
Thank you very much, Chair. Just a few things, Chair. Honourable members, there are two spreadsheets that were sent yesterday and last week, which are called dashboards. There's a dashboard for provincial grants, which emanate from the Dominion Revenue Bill. We're trying to simplify information that is contained on DORA for your easy use, so that you don't get lost into the big document. There is also a dashboard for local government provincial grants. Those dashboards are actually giving you the name of the grant, grant purpose, the performance of the grant in the previous financial year, as well as the proposed allocation. So we just simplify that information so that before you go into the door, you have a view and a picture of what the conditional grant looks like. Those that are not performing, we have highlighted them in red question of Honorable Rider, I've explained to him that we as content people for the committee, we develop a presentation for each member where we break down budgets for every province and for every municipality for individual members to go and brief their portfolio committees in provinces. So that presentation, members, will be circulated to you before you go to the briefing session with your provincial counterpart. It will have all the allocations of your municipalities under your constituency, the province, the provincial allocations as well, and everything. So that one is sorted, it's covered. The other issue, Chair, we have circulated a report. When we committed that beginning of the year, we would do certain things during the set plan in September. There are certain key focus areas that you said you would do. So we had done an assessment of what is it that the committee has achieved so far in view to revise the APP and the set plan of the committee going forward. So that report sets out some key interventions and some revisions and some of the issues that the committee will have to prioritize going forward. For instance, this is the opposite visit to the Eastern Cape, which is part and parcel of the report of this Parliament. It has not been implemented. We have elicited that particular item into the assessment report. There is budget for it. There is proposal that has been finalized also, besides with the secretary of the committee. The chair has seen the proposal in the past. We just need the guidance from the committee in terms of programming it, as you say, when the committee think that particular oversight can take place. It's important that we also not only focus on legislation processing, but follow through on allocations that the committee has actually approved as to whether they are spent according to the plans that were designed. This report also speaks about the sector, which the committee will need to have a conversation around to say when should that sector be taken. This report also speaks about the focus on infrastructure grants that the National Treasury colleague has spoken about. I think that dashboard that the DDG spoke about would come in handy in our work in trying to infuse it to our sum of all things that we've designed. Chair, we've also started tracking some of the resolutions as per the strategic plan that where the committee has made since the beginning of the term. Some of those reports will be shared as per your permission, Chair. So we request members, Chair, to assist us make input on this performance assessment report so that we can factor those input into the revised strategic plan of the committee and the APP of the committee going forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Loma. And let me take this opportunity to thank everybody for being so patient and being able to be part of this important session and empowering us. We really appreciate it, and we'll look for another day where we'll have enough time, hopefully, because sometimes you plan, and after planning, when you seniors are saying you are needed to do this and this, sometimes it disorganizes you. Our apologies on that. And I want to now take this opportunity to declare the meeting closed. Thank you very much.